It is demonstrated over and over again all over the world that an education is the pathway out of tough circumstances. People can rise up out of poverty and humble beginnings if they can get a decent education. So it appeals to many of us to help people get a good education. It certainly appealed to our guest this hour, appealed enough for him to sign up for Teach for America to teach school in a poor part of the country. Michael Kopperman tells the tale in Teacher, 2 years in the Mississippi Delta. Michael moved out of Mississippi and out of elementary school. He now teaches writing to low-income first-generation college students from diverse backgrounds at the University of Oregon. His work has been widely published, and he helps run the Oregon Writers Collective, and he's in Ashland for an event this afternoon on the Southern Oregon University campus. Michael Kopperman, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You begin the book actually past the end of the story in a return to the Delta, and I wonder just what that was like on its surface, knowing you were going back there and then driving back into this land of certainly some mixed feelings.
Yeah, I mean, my return was, a difficult and laden one in some ways. I mean, at first, of course, there's a familiarity and so much had happened there that had been formative for me. But I think that I had also put it off into a place in my head where I could sort of control it. And when you are back in a place that had been such a sort of crucible, and you realize that people's lives had gone on, you know, I think it was a little bit self-involved and solipsistic of me to imagine that somehow the world would have stopped without me being there. But returning there and finding things virtually unchanged, it was quite a shock when I first returned after about 6 or 7 years. And I just recently got to go back this last August with the book and visit some of the kids. And so I had, again, this sort of shock of recognition of returning to a landscape that I had, you know, thought about and written about and that had been so formative and that, of course, is still there.
One of the observations on your first return trip was looking at the high school and thinking, you know, some of the kids that I knew in fourth grade would be there by now. I mean, did you find that a bunch of them had made it into high school and stayed there for a while?
Made it into high school and stayed there. And actually, because I was there from 2002 to 2004, so that those kids then would have been actually, you know, of an age where most of them would be graduating and moving on. I found a whole variety of sort of outcomes with regards to kids that I had taught. I was able to meet with a bunch of them because I was in at least loose contact with some of them on social media. And so then I was able to find them and see what had sort of become of them later. And that was, of course, a really interesting and strange process, having written a book about my experience with them when they were, you know, 9 to 13-year-old fourth graders, and then encountering them as sort of young adults. It was a really strange experience.
Did you change a lot of the names for the book? I'm just guessing that was going to happen with the students anyway.
Yeah. the names and the places are all changed, including the school and even the county. So, you know, if someone...
Okay, I didn't find a promise, Mississippi. That's why I asked the question. No. Okay, so just, yeah.
I feel an obligation to protect the privacy of you know, children who I taught. And even though I also go to lengths within the book to sort of protect identifying markers, I still think that if you taught someone as a child and you were, you know, you were their teacher, that then you have an obligation to make sure that what you say about who they were as a child isn't something that, you know, finds them as an adult. So I worked with the publisher to make sure that that wasn't identifiable.
Let's talk about the basic structure of the school system where you went. I mean, there are some allusions in here to like Brown versus Board of Education, and that alone took Mississippi apparently a long time to comply with.
Yeah, I mean, it's my understanding of the particular history in the Delta. I mean, I think most of America thinks of, you know, Brown v. Board of Education as happening in 1954, and then somehow immediately the schools desegregating, or we have our images in our head of Little Rock, Arkansas, when some desegregation actually happened in other southern states. The state of Mississippi was the slowest, I think, in many ways to comply and even making a gesture at changing. So in 71, which is something like 16 or 17 years after Brown v. Board, the Supreme Court says you have to actually desegregate these schools. And so what happened essentially was a very small and short-lived experiment in integration. And then within a couple years, private schools were established all throughout at least the rural Mississippi Delta, in usually associated with white churches. And so that's that situation of white academies for white children and public schools, which are almost entirely black, persists today, is virtually unchanged, in fact, from 40 years ago.
And some of these white academies, certainly in the example you give in the town you were in, actually had the benefit of using buildings and facilities that were built by public money?
Yeah, in the particular county that I taught in, and in fact, interestingly enough, in the I lived across from what had been the publicly owned football field where the formerly white segregated publicly funded school had played football. In 71, when that change happened, apparently the school board signed over the rights to that field to the White Academy for like something sum that was incredibly small,
like a dollar
is I think what it says, mm-hmm. and that's what I was told.
So essentially, these communities found a way to keep separate systems for white students and black students.
That's right, and that situation of immense economic and racial segregation really persists today.
So Teach for America is supposed to help bridge some of the gaps. I mean, what was it that appealed you most about getting into Teach for America coming straight out of Stanford?
I mean, I was young and idealistic. I had, been involved the way that one gets involved in college in different kinds of social justice sorts of advocacy and activities, certainly in what I had heard about Teach for America and its mission, especially back in the early 2000s, which were sort of Teach for America's heyday. I was moved by the rhetoric. One day, all children of this nation will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. Certainly that is an immensely just mission. And so I imagined that I could be part of this movement, which would, I imagined, through some greater difficulty than was in the movies, but still within my, vast abilities as I assess them.
Well, he certainly gave it heart and soul. The book is called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. Michael Kopperman is the author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, appearing this afternoon on the Southern Oregon University campus. He'll come back here and talk more with us, and we'll take phone calls and emails from you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Michael Kopperman, who teaches English at the University of Oregon and is a graduate of Stanford University. He went pretty much straight from Stanford off to Teach for America and took a job teaching in a place that needed quality teachers and didn't have many of them. His book is called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. It is a real learning experience, well, for us to read it, but it certainly was a learning experience for Michael as well in the process of trying to put some education into fourth graders in deep Mississippi. Join us on the exchange with questions and comments, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Was there any training you had gotten before you finished your degree program at Stanford to learn how to teach?
There was a 5-week training module in inner city Houston, and it's called Institute. I think that they still have something similar to that. So you're doing some teaching of summer school.
All right. So nothing actually before your degree, just once you go to Teach for America.
Just once you enter. The idea of the program, and this is what I was going to sort of say about the rhetoric before your break, was that it takes exceptionally elite young people who have a great deal of idealism and sort of gives them this really heady rhetoric of change. And while the inequality that exists in our public schools is immense, the idea that, one young person, no matter how much merit they've demonstrated, is going to be able to somehow right, structural inequality and injustice is a little bit it's a little bit absurd in some ways. And so I was sort of sent off to get ready to teach, and teaching is its own art. And so I wasn't really prepared to face an actual classroom. I'm not sure that any amount of traditional teacher training would also have prepared me to teach in a system like Mississippi's. So I think that perhaps is one sort of point that proponents of Teach for America would make sure that we understood, which is to say that, the conditions in America's more under-resourced schools are much more difficult than the conditions that exist often in middle-class and upper-middle-class communities.
Just within Teach for America, how do they strike a balance between convincing you guys you're superheroes and you can save the world and also giving you some of the gritty reality of what you're about to face?
I think there was a good faith attempt to make me understand the gritty reality. I mean, I think I relate in the book this incident, which now looking back at, I understand what this woman was trying to convey, you know, which was what poverty actually means, what the needs of these children actually were, the relative inadequacy of at least my own experience in being prepared to sort of help and serve those children. But at the time, you know, with the arrogance of youth, you sort of imagine that you could do anything better than, you know, other people can. And I think in some ways Teach for America depends a little bit upon that lack of humility if you're going to ask someone to do a task as difficult as acting as, you know, a teacher, especially in an area that, you know, where students are relatively underserved.
Give us a sense of the place you ended up in Mississippi. I mean, what it was like in terms of size of the town and income disparities and income levels and that sort of thing.
Well, so the town is about 10,000 people. And the community that I call Promise in this book is very representative, I think, in many ways of much of the rest of the Delta. So the Delta is the alluvial floodplain of the Mississippi where the land was the richest and most arable. And so as a consequence, what you end up with is the greatest legacy of King Cotton. And so, you know, it's the blackest part of the United States in many ways. The area, both sides of the Mississippi River in Arkansas and Mississippi, something like 75% to 80% black. Whites still own most of the land and, you know, 95% of the businesses. So almost all of the resources are still concentrated in a very racially divided structure. The communities are very separated in some ways and meet, in fact, only in sort of like big box stores that reach rural areas, like, say, Walmart in general. Otherwise, you know, there's relatively separate cultures. And then the schools are segregated as well. So, you know, you end up with a black side of town marked by train tracks, and you cross, and all of a sudden you are in an area where, you know, most of the families are, in fact, poor and on welfare and black. The white side of town is, you know, these vast porches and white-columned colonials and, you know, Confederate flags flying in the windows. So it's a, you know, it's a very different place, at least for someone coming from, you know, from Oregon.
You got some interesting comments, I noticed, from white people, not just when they heard what you'd be doing there, teaching black children, but also comments about your own ethnicity. People seemed quite easy, actually, no matter what their shade of skin was, to talk about you and what you look like.
Right. Well, because I am extremely ethnically ambiguous, right? So my last name is Copperman. My father's family are Russo-Polish Jews. My mother's family is, well, I'm fourth generation Japanese Hawaiian. And so I look, you know, phenotypically something between potentially being Latino or being some kind of Asian. And in Mississippi, that was an oddity because except for the Delta Chinese, which is a sort of small population who built the railroads and have stayed, there really aren't any Asian people. In fact, there's hardly anyone beyond the black-white binary of the Delta, with a few very, very small communities as exceptions. So everyone would come up to me to try to sort of ask what I was. And in the black community, of course, that meant that I was a Chinaman or the living embodiment of Jackie Chan. And in the whites that I would encounter would immediately walk up to me and in what I think they imagined was a friendly way, you know, they would lead with something which I think today we would call a microaggression. So, you know, they would point out something very obvious about the fact that I was Asian or they liked sushi or, you know, they really liked Asian people. And then they would frequently move relatively quickly to telling me in coded or uncoded terms that they were sorry I had to teach in the public schools if that's what I was doing here. And they hoped that I understood that that it wasn't that they were racist, it was that the good blacks had all moved away and these that we have left are, and they would try to, you know, sort of let me know that in this black-white binary, they were happy to sort of marginally claim me. It was a very, very strange experience, although I have to say that in some ways I appreciated the writing being on the wall. I certainly felt I knew where I stood,
but... Yeah, so people gave you their indications right away. Well, A Teacher is the name of the book, 2 years in the Mississippi Delta. Michael Copperman, its author and our guest on The Exchange. Talk about first seeing your classroom. This is quite an experience.
Yeah, I mean, the classroom was in relative shambles. The teacher who had been there for a lot of years and had left, I think, had just sort of cleared out what she had that she cared about. And so, you know, there were torn posters on the wall. The desks were upturned. Everything was covered in a layer of dust. Textbooks from the, you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s were sort of strewn across the floor randomly, some with pages torn out. There were, you know, sort of no bookshelves, and the chalkboards themselves were, you know, what's the word, grayed or aged to the point where you almost couldn't make out the marks. So, you know, I hit that with 3 days until I was supposed to start teaching my first year, and tried to make some order of it.
Well, yeah, you can imagine the sequence that goes on from here. It's almost made for a movie in the sense that you can just see all the surfaces getting scrubbed and the mops being used and all that stuff and trying to get a dull shine out of the room. But then it comes time to meet the students. And how had you envisioned those first few moments of getting to know the students in your class, and how did it actually turn out?
I mean, I'm sure that what I had in my head inevitably was, you know, was culled from the litany of television movies of a white savior coming to a poor, you know, minority area and saving children from the lives they've been born into. So I think I imagined that somehow they would recognize in me the leader that I was going to be. What in fact happened, unsurprisingly, was that the children saw me and immediately recognized that they were going to have that Chinaman teacher, Jackie Chan, as their teacher, and commented on it in various ways that they found funny. And then, of course, there was sort of a second moment where then they actually had to face me in the classroom, and we were all sitting there looking at each other, trying to figure out exactly what this experiment in education was going to look like.
So then how do you prioritize what to talk about? I mean, do you start getting into, like, you know, it's really not nice to refer to people as Jackie Chan based on the way they look? How do you prioritize what to take on first with people who have so many challenges?
I mean, I think very quickly my kids put me in a separate category in their mind, which eventually was that I was their teacher. And that is a category, I think, which exists separate from everything else. These are kids who just simply hadn't encountered difference. So, you know, there's this strange thing that happens in America, I think, where we use this word racism and we throw it around a lot. And then, you know, people point out that, of course, people of color can be racist towards white people, and that other minorities can be racist towards other minority communities. And that's, of course, true. With the direction of the assumptions, stereotypes, or the relative ignorance in not having met an Asian person on behalf of the extremely poor kids who were on the wrong side of history, who I had the good fortune to teach, couldn't do me any harm. You know, I was a relatively privileged young man who had just had the good fortune to earn a Stanford education. They were not going to damage me, not those kids. You know, the hierarchy of the Delta and that divide between white and black and what that history meant towards them meant that racism directionally could harm them. So I talked to the kids, and I suppose that my classrooms of kids from those 2 years have a relatively greater understanding of multiculturalism than your average Delta kid does. And I think that prepares them better for, you know, for the rest of the world, whether they stay in the community of Promise, Mississippi, or whether they have, as some of them have, gone on to, you know, to college or to other things in other places.
Well, obviously the name of Promise, Mississippi, and the names of all the people in the book have been changed just a bit to make sure that nobody is immediately identifiable. The book is called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. Michael Kopperman is a Eugene native, went to Stanford University, went to Teach for America straight out of Stanford, and that's what resulted in his experiences and the book. And he'll be on the Southern Oregon University campus this afternoon at 3:30, speaking in the Meese Room at the Southern Oregon University Hannon Library, called Teaching for Whose America? Lessons in Separate and Unequal Education. You can join our conversation now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, if we could get past the classroom and the initial meeting with the students, then we have your discussion with the principal, where he produces a paddle from his desk.
Yeah, right, to let me know that, of course, he would do a good job with discipline. I read extensively about that in the course of the book, but really at this point, in only 2 states in the nation, Texas and Mississippi, does anyone use corporal punishment routinely in our public institutions. And of course, that violence, which is supposed to mete out culturally appropriate discipline, is directed almost entirely towards black students. I was not necessarily prepared for the system of corporal punishment as being routine. And my assistant principal, who was a bit of a sadist, realized very early on that I didn't have the stomach for watching children be paddled. You know, 3.5 foot long laminate striking surface that was, you know, sort of designed to inflict maximum pain, wielded by a 6'4", 250-pound man who had been on a baseball scholarship in the past.
So you knew how to swing something, yeah.
Right. And, you know, I at the time, I think that what many of us who had to work within that system told ourselves, at first at least, was that we were overwhelmed, that this was somehow all right, that there were studies which had shown that in certain circumstances, corporal punishment, if meted out fairly, didn't necessarily damage children, which is not really true. But we wanted, I think, to be forgiven, and we were overwhelmed. I eventually stopped sending children to the office if I knew that the assistant principal was going to be there paddling children, after having witnessed a bunch of different instances in which kids were sort of paddled and realizing that this was not, in fact, all right.
But did you go home at night sometimes and think, who have I become? I mean, what am I part of here?
Well, and I think I did that every night for, you know, at least the 4.5 months when I was struggling the most in my first year, or maybe at different points in the course of those 2 years. But the first time that I sort of watched all of these kids get paddled, I think I describe in the book this one particular day in which the assistant principal paddled 10 of my kids in my classroom in sort of a strange way, trying to make a point, but I think also trying to point out to me that I had asked him to return discipline and this was what discipline looked like. Those sorts of times and instances caused me, you know, to question what I was doing at all, because I didn't come to teach in a low-income area to show children that the world was unjust and that power went to the bully with the biggest stick, and that to not listen to what I had to say was to have the maximum amount of pain inflicted upon them.
Given the context, I mean, the fact that violence is part of the backdrop here, were there times when you feared for your own safety?
You know, I think that feared for my own safety, I would say probably not so much. Perhaps at times when I was in certain situations in white rural areas and parts of town I shouldn't necessarily have been in. But I think in general, I think I was safe on the black side of town. People knew who I was.
And from the kids, I mean, in the classroom, yeah. Some of these kids were fairly boisterous and muscular. And
there were times when my classroom was out of control. There were many times when my frustration level exceeded the level that I could really maintain my temper at. But I don't think threatened was exactly the right word. I think that the moral peril was to myself. What would I do when I couldn't get these kids who I had imagined I had come to help to do a lesson or sit down or listen to my authority?
It sounds like you scared yourself a time or two, maybe more than any of the kids ever scared you.
Yeah. I mean, I think I describe in this book an incident in which I, you know, threw a child out of the classroom by his collar. And, you know, what was interesting about that exchange was that convinced him, in fact, that I was dominant.
Well, and that's the odd thing, because there's another comment pretty close in time relationship to that where somebody says to you, well, it's a good thing that somebody cared enough about this girl to whoop her,
yeah.
About a member of her family. But, I mean, this idea that violence shows caring.
Right. And, you know, I think that those kinds of violences within communities, actually the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about this in his book Between the World and Me. But, you know, those violences are a way to show caring, but they're a way to try to keep, you know, people from the sorts of consequences that are out there for, you know, for acting wrong. I don't think that violence necessarily shows caring, though a parent who strikes their child can certainly love them. I think that, you know, we have a whole body of research that suggests, in fact, that parenting is best done without striking children or whooping them, whatever the cultural practices are of a particular area or population. But I think that you know, the people who were urging me to, as I was often asked to do, to, you know, just whoop kids in the classroom myself, was not something which I myself was able to sort of reckon with, sustain, or do. And I think that the few times when I did lose my temper and came close to acting in anger, I think I probably lost considerably more than was gained by those actions.
We'll talk about the process of gaining control over the classroom, which, as you pointed out, took a few months. Michael Kopperman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His 2 years with Teach for America in the heart of the Mississippi Delta, told in his book, Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. He now teaches English to diverse populations at the University of Oregon, and he's on the Southern Oregon University campus for an appearance this afternoon at 3:30 at the Meese Room in the Hannon Library. Brought into town by Echo Fields in the sociology department at SOU. You can join our conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange. We have one call waiting. We'll get to you in just a moment. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Kopperman and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Michael Kopperman, a Eugene native who didn't go to the University of Oregon. He teaches there now. He teaches English to diverse groups of students. And he decided when he left Stanford University to go into Teach for America and ended up spending 2 years in the Deep South. He tells the story in his book, Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta, now in print. And he's also going to be speaking this afternoon at the Meese Room at the Southern Oregon University Hannon Library at 3:30. You can join our conversation on the Exchange right now at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So a few months to gain control over the classroom. Was there a particular incident that things hinged on, or was it just a matter of a sequence of events sort of gelling at last?
I mean, I imagine that I got better, but I think it's somewhere in the sort of fever dream of those really difficult months when I didn't have control. I think what ended up happening was that I had by chance or circumstance been given a lot of really difficult boys who had a lot of problems, and I simply lost a couple of those kids, whether they were moved within the foster system or whether their families moved away. And suddenly the sort of balance of my classroom switched a little bit, and I was able to actually begin to teach. And so, you know, it's really hard to sort of look back and say what actual moment there was, but, you know, there's a fine balance in a classroom, I think, between chaos and between something which is relatively functional when actual teaching and instruction is going on. And something switched, you know, at some point, at least in my mind, when I look back, you know, I can remember standing in front of that classroom one day and looking out at the kids and realizing that all eyes were down and, the children's pencils were scratching to the page, and that people were actually doing something like what I had asked them to do.
So there were obviously people did learn things in the classroom. I mean, and it sounds like some of the students were fairly promising and could do the work very well.
The children were bright and exceptional and brilliant and able and deserving, I think, of opportunities. They were children, like children are anywhere else, and they were curious. I still think about those children all the time. In many ways, they've made me into an educator, and those kids were capable of a lot, and they honestly did a lot. I mean, it's interesting, but at least my second year taught, I think, much better than I did my first year, and I met with a number of the kids who I taught both in the first and second year when I was just back in Mississippi. You know, I carried a lot of guilt over the things that I hadn't done. But to talk to those kids, especially the three of them who I spoke to who have gone on to graduate or nearly graduate from four-year institutions, I realized that that year in the classroom, whatever it was I did, I managed to convey to them that I cared about them, that I expected them to succeed, that college was a possibility, that they were smart and able, that reading and writing mattered, and, you know, they all said that that year actually made a tremendous difference, that much of the rest of their time in school was a blur, but that they remembered all kinds of details about the year and all of these relatively good things that I had forgotten. So, you know, I think this is what our memory does, right? Our memories are inconstant, and we remember the trauma.
We have the negativity bias, right? But
yeah.
But they remember good things. And that's the big one, is they knew that you cared.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I think that teachers often have to learn to forgive themselves their worst teaching experiments. Every educator knows that their first year in the classroom is a disaster, no matter where it is that they teach. And they also remember their mistakes, I think, much more than the 100 times that they, you know, were patient with a child or gave them a second chance or explained and explained or, you know, created some kind of lesson which actually had something in it that had some life. So I think that, you know, on the balance, when I look back at those years, actually, I feel that I did the best that I could. And I don't feel that I did such a terrible thing. You know, I was being critical of Teach for America, but I do believe that its mission is just. I just believe that the organization itself, you know, at times has a problem with the headiness of its rhetoric as opposed to the reality of what it is that you're actually asking people to do, and also what that impact is on children and communities who, you know, are seeking an education.
Grab the headphones. I want to take a call here from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Michael Kopperman about his book, Teacher.
Fascinating. Thank you very much. I have a question. Fourth grade, third, fourth, fifth grade are so important in language development, reading and writing. And I wonder, there's been, I know, work over the last 20 years about types of language within groups, especially a group that's lived together for possibly hundreds of years in the South, where you have a racial language, you have a regional language, and then you have language as a result of poverty. And I wondered how you approached those levels of language differences with someone from a more educated Northwest culture.
That's an excellent question, Connie. Thanks for that. And in fact, it's a good question because you do provide in the dialogue in the book, it's clear that it's written exactly as it was said. So a lot of like, go and do this, that kind of thing.
Yeah, these children were speakers of African-American vernacular English in the Delta regional idiom. And that is a correct language and grammar. That has a correct grammar unto itself. And that language was, by the way, immensely rich and inventive and even beautiful. And yet those children were going to be assessed at the end of my year in the classroom because fourth grade is a testing year, and then on through the course of their school careers and their ability to speak correct or standard, you know, American English in perhaps a Mississippi idiom. Which, of course, and we know this from all kinds of tests, right? It's a tremendous barrier to success. I went out of my way to tell children that the way that they spoke was correct, that I valued it. I did not correct the ways that kids spoke. If anything, I think I ended up taking on more of what those children said than perhaps they took on of what I said. But at the same time, I had to teach them to code switch, which I think most people who come from particular areas and regions where someone speaks a dialect of English have to learn to do. So we needed to write grammatical sentences, and they needed to understand, you know, how to control the conventions of grammar. Of course, kids are much better at that than adults are, so they were relative sponges. And most of those kids, I would say, learned very quickly how to make that transfer. I think that the real challenge actually is in not telling children that the way that they speak is wrong.
Let's talk about getting to know the kids and their families. I mean, you were trying to make sure that you could maintain contact from early on and get to know the parents so that you'd be partners in the education here, which sounds like it blew up on you in a number of ways.
Well, I mean, there were a range. I had some wonderful parents who really wanted to be involved in the education of their children and who really believed strongly in perhaps absurdly in my ability to you know, somehow give these kids opportunities and enrichment and help them. I had some failures of communication, which was in part my not understanding the particular culture of the place that I was in. I had, you know, been told that I should have close contact with parents, and so I tried to call every parent every night. And so, you know, I describe in this book one particularly difficult situation in which I was calling a young man's house over and over and over again, despite the fact that he asked me many times to not call his home, though he wouldn't explain why. And there was no message machine, and they had caller ID. And so what was happening was that he was being beaten with a fan belt every time that his his mother's boyfriend saw that my number had come up.
Just on that you had called produced the violence.
Right. So, you know, I think when I look back at that situation, I think rightfully I have an immense amount of guilt about it. But things like that happened, unfortunately, relatively frequently.
Talk about moments in the classroom when, I mean, teachers talk all the time about seeing the light go on in a kid's eyes. You must have seen that a few times yourself in 2 years in this room.
I mean, I can think of hundreds of times, although, of course, those things sort of blend to a kind of repetition in my mind. But, you know, I think about certain days when I did very specific lessons. I was a better writing teacher. I'm a writing teacher today, and I'm a writer. And so, you know, I brought in an apple pie one day and, you know, to work on descriptive writing and similes and, you know, the sensory detail of taste, touch, sight, smell, sound. And the kids, you know, got to smell the pie and they got to, you know, and I played this whole thing up about how we couldn't do taste, right, of course, which I think any adult would understand would be an absurdity if you were going to bring children an apple pie.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, but at the very end when, of course, they got to eat it, the amount of excitement that those kids had and then the quality of their descriptions was exceptional. And, you know, I think that I can think about that. I can think about the ways that I taught reading especially. I was able to have a vast classroom library and have kids read their own books, and I would go around and talk to each of them individually about their books as they were sort of keeping these reading journals. This is based on this sort of four blocks method of teaching that was pioneered by Patricia Cunningham that I had sort of bought into. And, you know, hearing the kids talk about the books that they were reading and what they meant to them, both in terms of their personal connections and then how they came to understand, you know, what reading was and what it meant. I can picture the faces of those children, and I think many of them came away understanding that reading was not this burdensome thing which you were forced to do, but actually something from which you could enter a different world or gain a certain amount of delight. So,
you know, so many students now are dealing, and teachers then are having to deal with it because the students are so into the electronics. Was that an issue yet? Because this is about 15 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah, this was before the age of the modern electronics, right? Before the age of the dopamine rush from checking a device. Not like the children that I contend with now at the university who, you know, in many ways are wired. Kids didn't have cell phones, at least, back in those years. Which I think was a nice thing, at least for elementary school. I see my nephews now who are of this age, and they are utterly wired and immersed, and they have their own phones, and they, you know, are out there, I'm not sure exactly what with their communication devices.
Was there a key moment for you, a moment when in the first year in particular, when you went, okay, this is the moment that makes all the bad stuff worth it?
Wow, in the first year. I mean, I think there must be a dozen mm-hmm. different moments or times in that first year when something went differently. It's strange, but because one of the things that I allowed myself to do at some point in the first year was just sort of enjoy the children and play. I think about recess and playing kickball, you mm-hmm. know, on a field on some sunlit day where, you know, I was just enjoying the kids and they were enjoying the fact that their teacher was playing kickball with them. You know, but there are probably 1,000 moments in the classroom that first year as things got better in which I can think, okay, you know, things are changing here. Things are working here. This project that we're doing is working. I did a poetry unit, I think, the first year, and I think that was probably one of the relative successes where I was able to get at sort of the natural poetry of those children's voices and the depth of their experiences and have that come out.
There is still a Teach for America, yes?
Yes.
And people are still going into it. My sister-in-law did it a few years ago. What can you offer to anyone thinking about it, or what would you propose to its leaders to change it? I'm sure you give them a little feedback at some point.
Well, and I should say that my perception of Teach for America, and Teach for America has taken a massive number of hits in the public eye, for very good reason, I think, in some ways, because of the distance between what they were suggesting and because of the sort of arrogance of suggesting that they were a solution in a sort of go-it-alone kind of way. They have really reconfigured their efforts. They are partnering with local institutions, teachers, in professional development. They're not trying to take only from their own ranks. They have moved away from at least some of the more troubling support of parts of the charter school movement. And they're trying to put their energy into public education with partners to be a part of a solution. To me, when I went back to Mississippi, I stepped into the room of teachers there, and I realized that something had changed, because when I was in the Delta, I was one of perhaps, you know, maybe 1/8 of a core of 70 teachers in the Delta were people of color, and maybe 5 of them or 6 of them were black. In the room that I entered, more than half of the room were African-American teachers, and it turned out that they were recruiting from within Mississippi. And so as an engine of diversity, which I guess nationally is above 50% in the organization, I tend to think that you could do worse than to go learn about public education and the conditions in our public schools there. So I would say have a humility.
Okay. We certainly learn a lot from your experience, from what you went through in Teach for America. The book is called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. Michael Kopperman from Eugene wrote it. He is currently teaching at the University of Oregon. He'll be talking about this same subject this afternoon, called Teaching for Whose America? Lessons in Separate and Unequal Education. That's today at 3:30 at the Meese Room at the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University. Michael Kopperman, thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.